This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this.
You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
I'm sitting here with Kibwanisi from the group Anishinaabe Confederacy to Invoke Our Nationhood. I'm wondering if you want to maybe introduce yourself and give a really, just in a few words, a brief background on what ACTION is, what it's about, and what you've done so far.
My name is Red-Tailed Hawk, and I'm from the Bear Clan, and I identify myself with coming from Mother Earth. With ACTION, it's a confederacy to unite our people, and so we, with everything that's, with all of the policies that we're sort of subjected to, we've been divided for too long, and so we're basically creating a confederacy that would unite all different indigenous people across what's called Turtle Island. So that's what the confederacy is about. The one aspect that we are involved in that is part of, that represents the people we're in our region, is Oshkamazig, the reclamation, and located in Owenda Provincial Park. So that's what we are doing. And so now we are actively going around and trying to unite with other people in their struggle as well. So like there's the Algonquins of Powhagan Lake, and so we are trying to perhaps get them to be represented in our confederacy. I could go on with, you know, Grassy Narrows, just anybody that's willing to unite with us. So like a lot of work has been now focused on Six Nations, and so we're really trying to reestablish that Haudenosaunee Anishinaabe friendship belt. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the work that we are on the ground, you know, actively doing right now.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that one of the projects that your group has engaged in, the Oshkamazi camp, which has started to garner a lot of support from various groups, was started as a protest camp. Can you explain why the camp itself was started and what it was protesting?
Okay. It was a response to physically, like, go out there and to put some action to our opposition to it. So there was, like, we fought
your opposition
to the specific land claims policy,
okay,
known as the Coldwater Narrows Land Claim Settlement.
Okay.
And so There was no avenue for our voice to be heard in any sort of council that there was put out there, you know, like in their information sessions and things like that nature. And there was no avenue. Like, we thought that the people who were in opposition to this were not being taken seriously by way of the, in the negotiation process. There was no avenue for the people that who didn't want to be a part of this. It was all or nothing. And so, and the way that the whole policy was set up, the specific land claims policy is set up, it's set up in favor of Canada. Like, it's set up so that they are the judge, jury, you know, and the defendant of their own crimes, right? And our voices were not being heard. We weren't being taken seriously. And basically the way that it was set out was that if you were in opposition of this, then you really didn't have a voice, because there was quite a few, like there was just a few of us that actually were really quite vocal about the opposition of it. And so on the days, like when we started this camp in Coldwater, there was very little preparation. We had like about 1 week of preparation. And so what we were going to do is that we were supposed to set up a sort of like an information booth, but like I said, we didn't have too much time to prepare. And so we kind of set up on the day of the vote. And that vote took place on April 14th of 2012. And of course, like, it didn't pan out. You know, like, the people went and voted in favor anyways. Like, so I think that the people were not properly informed of the consequences of it. They just saw the money, you know. They just saw the carrot dangling in front of the horse, so to speak, and they just went for it. And you know, and the thing is that our people have been so impoverished for such a long time that any amount of money is almost like, you know, winning the lottery, and it's really sad. So that's how the camp has started. And like you mentioned, that, you know, we've been gaining a lot of support from not just indigenous nations, but from our you know, settler allied nations, if you want to call. But it's taken on a lot of work that to go out there and to do outreach, and it's quite a lot of work for just the two of us, you know, because we have to maintain, you know, a presence in the park, and we have to go out there and to show support, you know, with all the other struggles that are out there, and to continuously engage in other struggles in other people, you know, like, and now there's this, you know, this I Don't Know More sort of campaign, and it seems that the people are sort of politicized, but like, what are the people really fighting for, right? Why are the people, are they moving? Are they moving just to keep the small little smidgens of treaty rights that are sort of governed under the Indian Act, you know? And so it's like, we're trying to broaden people's perspectives and to really see the bigger picture, that it's not just about these menial little, you know, these little rights that we have, whether it be dental or health or whatever it is, but to actually go out there and say, hey, you know what, we have treaty rights that lay claim to 90 or 95% of all of Canada, you know? So let's look at the bigger picture, and let's look at something that is much bigger, but also I love that word, capitalizing, but capitalizing on this movement, but also incorporating, you know, a vision of unity, because like the way that I see things with the two-rule wampum is that, you know, we were supposed to be nation to nation, brothers, sisters, allies, and ever since the inclusion of the British North American Act in 1867, everything became a division. Like, we were given complete claim to all the land. And I think that the way that it was set up was so that they wanted us to sign these treaties, but they couldn't get us all to move into one spot. So they had to say, okay, well, we'll give this all to you if you just move into this little spot, and we're going to hold it on. We're going to hold, you know, your lands for you, and we're going to, you know, sort of take care of all, you know, the finances and everything. But we just need you to move into this one little spot. And the way that I believe that it was set up was that they were never going to give it to us. Mm-hmm. Is that they were just going to... It was a method to get us to move into reserves, and then thus began the divide and conquer method, you know. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get, you know, to use the momentum. People are politicized now, you know. Now let's just try and get them to see things in the bigger picture. And we tie it, like, Ashkamazig is the seventh fire prophecy, right? And the only way that we can continue on into the next future is if we unite all the people. And we're not talking about just indigenous people. We're talking about every single person on Turtle Island, on Mother Earth, right? Every single person. That no one can be excluded, right? Because everyone has to buy into it. Because a capitalist system does not work with indigenous people. Like say if you have like sort of a sovereign way of life that is, you know, land-based and whatnot. You can't be out there, you know, living your sovereign life, you know, next to a gold mine or next to a tar sands. Like, it just doesn't work, you know. Like, it, so everybody has to buy into this. And how do you do it? You know, you go with this vision of unity. And I have a vision that I see that people can buy into, and hopefully that we gain enough support from other nations to buy into this vision of unity, so that we can live more harmonious with Mother Earth. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain for me a little bit more what the settlement is, what the process has been?
I can't really elaborate too much on what the process has been, but I do know that it's taken 30 years. Quite honestly, I wasn't aware of it until last year. I mean, like, I knew about it for 3 years ago, but more so just in the final months leading up to it. Mm-hmm. The process really was that somebody had, it's the specific land claim is basically, it's being, I don't know what that word is, but they're saying that it's a compensation. Mm-hmm. And when it's not a compensation, what happened was back in 1836, our hereditary chiefs had gone to Toronto to secure our nationhood and our land and to be recognized as sovereign people. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that they were tricked into signing a piece of paper that basically surrendered everything. And then thus we were moved on, you know, into a reserve and, you know, different reserves and tiny little islands and stuff. So now somebody had gone to school, had done some research, had found out about this, and brought it to the people, to the four, or I should say three reserves, and said, hey, you know, there was a great injustice that happened to our people back then, like, let's do something about it. And so then they petitioned the government, who was finally recognized, I think it was like in the early 2000s, so 2003 or 4 or 5, one of those years where the Canadian government recognized that, you know, that the people had a valid court case, mm-hmm. saying, hey, like, there was an injustice here, like, now correct it. And so the Canadian government decided that they were going to sit down and to begin negotiations on what they were going to do. But then they developed all these policies on how they were actually going to settle these things. And they always create these policies that work out in their favor, right? And so this policy is designed to basically to get us to surrender all title to the land and water once and for all. Mm-hmm. So they didn't do it correctly the first time. And so now they're saying, okay, well, now that you're okay, now that you guys are educated, you guys have doctors and lawyers on this, legal teams and whatnot to understand the language, now we want you to do it again. You know, like, we want to make you surrender, you know, once and for all. And that's what this is all about. You know, like, it's about gaining that land, right, to getting us to surrender.
So in essence, what this settlement is doing is continuing the theft of land from Anishinaabe communities by the Canadian government. And what they're doing is they're essentially compensating you further. But they're giving more money to ensure that the land that they've already taken is theirs for good. Is that generally the idea?
Yeah, you could probably say that. They're saying it's a compensation, right?
Mm.
Now, you know, I'm not too sure, like, how, like, from my perspective, what an adequate compensation would look like. But I could begin with, first of all, recognizing our nationhood.
Mm.
And I could begin with having a land base and being recognized as sovereign people and being recognized with our inherent way of life and not to further encroach on that. I can begin with that.
Mm.
You know, if they want to pony up some cash, I don't think that $307 million nearly adequates anything, you know, like, perhaps maybe to one family. You know, hey, sorry about the genocidal policies. Sorry about the residential schools.
Mm.
Sorry about, you know, the theft and the reservations. Sorry about all of the injustices we've done to you. Like, myself, my mother, she was taken away into residential school, and because of this whole Indian Act and the policies that are laid out, she fell right into the trap, into the system that they have outlined, you know, and she no longer exists, right? Like, she died, she committed suicide. My father, he died as well. Like, the residential schools affected his father. And, you know, because of this, the family ties were severed. The people are, like, the spirit, you can say, has been busted, has been broken. And, you know, my father fell to alcoholism as well. So then you're going to ask me, okay, how am I going to compensate you for the loss of your mom and your father?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you were raised in a resident or in a foster home? I could tell you right now that there's no way that I could put a number on my mother, you know. but it probably start with something about in a couple hundred million dollars just for myself, right? Like, so 307 million to be divided among 6,000 or 8,000 people, whatever that may be, that's completely ridiculous. And of course, the fact that the way that it's structured so that we have to buy our own lands back, you know, and also too, that I should touch on that the specific land claims that they're talking about, they're only talking about like a little tract of land that exists on the on Highway 12 in Coldwater. When the actual treaty, or sorry, not the actual treaty, the actual, like the reserve that was set out back in 1830, I believe it was, consisted of like 650,000 square acres. And the one that they're negotiating right now is only for 10. So like when they put it down, when they scale it down to just 10, and you're saying, oh, it's only 10,000 acres, so then I think that, you know, then they can say, oh, well, 307 million is enough to compensate for that little 10,000 square acres. But if the people really understood that it was 650,000 square acres, you know, then they'd be like, okay, well, that number should be 650 million, 650 billion. You know, like, I don't know, like,
billion,
I,
sounds,
you know,
closer.
Yeah. So I mean, like, so that's just the way that I see things, right? Mm-hmm. I know that Bill Montour, he keeps going and giving the town of Brantford a bill every year, and I can't remember how many billion it is at right now, right? But I mean, mm-hmm. why don't our people do that? Why don't, you know?
Yeah, well, I once went to a presentation from Phil Montour from yeah. Six Nations, and he had a figure that Six Nations is owed in back rent payments from squatters and settlers and the government trillions of dollars
yeah.
just for the Haldimand Tract.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure. I mean, like, but for me, it's never about the money, right?
Mm.
You know, it's not about the money. It is about the land and our way of life, and that should be recognized, you know, and we shouldn't have to be buying back, you know, like, it's just so ridiculous the way that it's a complete fallacy. It's a complete, and it's really sad and disheartening, you know, to see that our people were so consumed by poverty that $10,000, but like with our reserve, Beausoleil First Nation, it was 10,000, but I believe the other figures were a little bit more, mm-hmm. so that's why they were more inclined to do it. And this, you know, what this is, it's a divide and conquer method, right? You know, it's dividing us from our land base, you know, and that's what it's all about for me. It's dividing us from our land base, swinging this money in front of us, dividing us from other indigenous communities around, like, because then everybody says, well, how come they got money, you know, and then, you know, then how come they got this much, you know, and then when they start doing these things, like, it just perpetuates this division among the people. And what's not being recognized here, or we should actually see what this is really for, right? This is the way that the colonial government is setting this up is so that they can extinguish their fiduciary responsibility to the treaties, and in one fell swoop they're undermining all kinds of treaties, right? And they're just using us as a precedent on what they're going to do with everybody else. This land that we're on, in fact, I believe Toronto is a part of it too, is the One Dish One Spoon treaty that 500 nations will all agree to at one time. And that agreement was that if there was any time, any mention of that we had to surrender land or we had to do anything like that, that all nations would have to come together and we would all have to agree to it, because everybody had like equal access to people's resources, right? That we were allowed to go hunt and fish and trap and to do other things on other people's territories, right? Like, we recognized that the people, that was their territory, but, you know, we would sit down and say, hey, like, you know, this was an agreement because that we all share, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how is four communities accepting a land surrender package equally sharing with the rest of the people represented in the One Dish, One Spoon? You know, so it's, again, that divide and conquer. That's mm-hmm. the way that the colonial government always operates, right? Mm-hmm. Divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
And you have been listening to an interview with Gibwanisi of the Oshkamazdag Unity Camp, located at Council Rock in Anishinaabeg Territory, near Midland, Ontario. The interview was undertaken in late December 2012 by Caitlin Stacey for Grand River Radical Radio. And we are now going to take a short musical break. This is A Tribe Called Red with their song, The Road. It's a song dedicated to Teresa Spence. And that was A Tribe Called Red with their song, The Road, which is going out to Chief Teresa Spence. And we return to our interview with Gibwanisi of the Oshkamazdig Unity Camp, located at Council Rock in Anishinaabeg Territory, near Midland, Ontario. The interview was undertaken in late December 2012 by Caitlin Stacey for Grand River Radical Radio.
So you were saying earlier that even though the process for this settlement has been going on for 30 years or close to 30 years, that you only heard about it in the last year.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've found is common amongst people in the four communities?
I think so. But I think I think what's really common is the fact that there was very little complete understanding of what it actually is. Mm. It's really sad to see people, you know, referring it to it as a treaty. It's not a treaty. Like, it was never a treaty. It was an experiment, right? It was an experiment. And I think that's where Canada is, like, saying, you know, it's a compensation. We're sorry that we experimented on you as the first reserve. So, I mean, like, I was not aware that any of this process was going on. And I was not aware completely of the actual history until this year. And also, like, within the whole context of the package itself, the land surrender package, the legal jargon that is in there, You basically have to be a lawyer to understand it. Mm. And so I had about 1 week of preparation. So right before they were asking for everybody to vote on it, I had injured my back, and so I had about 2 weeks before the vote. And so I sat down with my computer. I went through all the documents. There was probably about 9 different sort of packages that were in it to read. So I started reading it one by one, understanding a little bit about the history, understanding about the way everything was sort of structured. And then I had to go onto Google, and I had to open up a legal dictionary and understand what fee simple meant and what absolute surrender to certain sections of the Indian Act was. And then once I sort of understood it, I understood that it was completely abolishing, any ties to any treaties that we have, And then once I understood that, then I knew that, if you have no land, and you're accepting this way of life, and also fee simple too, that you're becoming a Canadian citizen to pay taxes in the end, right? And so I was like, wow, this is really clever by their part. And I was like, but lucky thing, I was gifted with a little bit of a brain, so I could understand, I could see through the language, and I was just like, wow, there's no way that I can put my name on anything that absolutely surrenders anything. So, of course, I didn't even partake in the vote. Mm. I kept the package. I ended up giving it away to somebody, a news reporter or something, so they could go and investigate a little bit further. But yeah, so...
I mean, I remember reading back in the summer that the community of Nawash held a vote that wasn't even valid because it didn't meet the minimum requirements for voter turnout, which seems to suggest that even by that, dubious standard, community participation was really abysmal, really not adequate for negotiating a settlement like this. Do you feel like the communities have been consulted appropriately?
I don't think so. I mean, I was talking with one of the community members from Nawash as well, and they have their own settlement going on, and all of a sudden this one was introduced, and they were questioning why were they included into this one, and why was their one that they're a part of distinctly being pushed to the back burner. And I think it had something to do with, from this gentleman's eyes, was that the compensation payout for them for this one was only $22 million, whereas the one that they were involved in was also just like this one, was in the several hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And so they, going back to your original question about the voter turnout, one of the policies that is being introduced into that bill, C-45, the omnibus bill, is that it's saying that they're changing the referendum sort of structure so that even if just a handful of people show up, and there's a majority of people that, of the handful, so to say 5 people show up and 3 people say yes and 2 people say no, they're still going to take that as a valid surrender or agreement or whatever you want to call it. And that's exactly what they said the last time, because when they didn't have a fair number of people to turn out, when they held the second one, they said that it doesn't matter. Even if one person turns out and votes yes, that's it. It's doable. And so it's almost like they were practicing on us again for this omnibus bill that's going through. It's like, oh, it'll work, these things will work because it's been practiced on and the people will turn out. It doesn't matter what it is, right? So
that makes it pretty tricky to boycott.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me about what's happening this week.
Right now, the money is being dished out, doled out for our specific community. It's on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I think for Rama it's on Friday. And what we have come up with, with some of our good friends, I can probably say that they're our brothers, in this struggle. We sort of took an idea about, instead of being more divisive between us at Oshkamazig, who are opposed to the land surrender, and to those who are sort of being strong-held into voting or accepting this money is that we're just going to acknowledge that, you know, like that, yeah, like there's no changing their mind, right? Like, because they're so set on this, right? And it's just like, okay, well, let's create sort of like a backdoor safety net so that we can have a document that acknowledges that they did this under duress. So that way, if something ever happens, in which it will happen, I can almost 100% guarantee you that when things start changing and the policies are being implemented, that the people will say, hey, we got tricked. And the government is going to say, well, sorry, like, it was in plain language. You know, you signed it. Too bad for you. And well, with this document, this declaration that we have, it's saying that the people signed it under duress because of, you know, just being impoverished for such a long time that they felt that there was no real avenue for them to come out other than to accept this $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000, whatever it may be. And so that way we actually have something for the people that they can fall back on. And that's what this is about. That's what Anishinaabe Confederacy to Invoke Our Nationhood is all about. It's about fighting for the people, right? It's not about causing any divisiveness, you know, and it's about taking this unity, taking a negative and against all odds, turning it into a positive. And that's what it's all about. Fighting the legal system with their own legislation, with their own laws. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's, I'm really thankful for the person who came up with that idea. It was really awesome. It was a really slick move on their part.
Tell me more about this vision of unity that the Ashkenazi camp is promoting.
The vision of unity that we have unites all people. This goes back to our prophecies. So if I could just sort of reiterate what Ashkenazi means in our language, it refers to the seventh fire prophecy, where the new people would pick up the things that were left behind. And those things that were left behind are our teachings, our culture, our ways, everything that is encompassed in what Anishinaabe people identify themselves as. And that that they begin to petition elders and these knowledge keepers to come out. Because we find ourselves at the precipice of disaster and the end of life for Earth's people, that we come to a fork in the road, where one way leads us more to materialism, individualism, capitalism, colonialism, and ends our way of life because we destroy the very earth that we live on and depend on. Then the other way is where the Ashkenazic people pick up all these teachings and decide that they want to return to the natural way. And in doing so, we can go on for many more years. But the eighth fire prophecy says that it cannot be exclusive to just the Anishinaabe people, that all people will have to buy into this, otherwise it will not work. And so now we recognize that what we are doing to Mother Earth is going to kill, and it already is killing us, right? We can take the thousands upon thousands of people that are dying from these, from cancers and diabetes and whatever you want, like all these different rare cancers from the tailings ponds, from radiation, you know, that's coming from nuclear power plants and uranium. Like when they flood the waters, you know, mercury gets in, it's just, our people will not, no people, not just Anishinaabe people, all people will die from this. And I think that the people are starting to recognize, you know, the people are starting to recognize that we can no longer continue this way of life. And so it's recognizing that there are distinct indigenous ways of life, not just on Turtle Island, but in all parts of the globe, the Philippines, Asia, Africa, South America, anywhere, right? And recognizing that there are people that are still out there that who live a natural way of life, that can live harmoniously with Earth, right? And then to be able to convince people that say, hey, if we don't make a drastic change right now, that if everybody doesn't stop doing what we're doing and to make a concerted effort, then we're all going to die. You know, and we need to do this. So we need to really run with the people that know how to do this, right? That know how to. And it just so happens here on Turtle Island that the indigenous people here, Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, or whatever you identify yourself as, that we still have these knowledge keepers. We still have these distinct ways of life, right? But we cannot go back and live on the land if the people continue to pollute it. So the people who are working actively in these oil mines and or oil fields and mines and all that, they have to buy into this as well. So the struggle for the Ashkamazic people, the seventh generation people, is to be able to rise up as a nation and to be able to unite the entire globe, basically. You know, and it said the way that I was told that it will be the most difficult task ever put to people ever. And I concede that it is the most difficult task, just trying with our own people, right? But I have hope, I have vision, I have faith. I have faith in the Creator. I have faith in people. Creator made people. So if people are made from Creator and everything that Creator makes is sacred, then I have to have faith in the sacredness of creation.
All right. Thank you so much.
And that was our interview with Gibwan Isi of the Ashkamazdig Unity Camp, located at Council Rock in Anishinaabeg Territory, near Midland, Ontario. The interview was undertaken in late December 2012 by Kaylin Stacey for Grand River Radical Radio. And for more information on the Ashkamazdig Unity Camp, check out oshkamazdig.org. That's oshkimaadziig.org.